You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yeah, exactly. As a matter of fact, we were able to last time troll in. Sometimes we say, well, we're not trolling this week. We are trolling. And that's because most of the pelagic game fish that we're going to talk about today are surface running or just under the surface running fish, and you got to have a boat to go out and get them. Unless you get really lucky and a mai-mai comes up and bites your short casting bait. Not likely to happen too often. Mark Fitzgerald, he is the new pelagic fisheries ecosystem scientist at the council, joins us again. We got to know Mark a little bit last time, and I thought we'd sort of follow up Mark in a little bit, to talk a little bit today about, now that you got your feet on the ground and you're ready to go, what role you are expected to play, and what are going to be some of the first real big projects that you get your teeth into?
Well, right now I've been getting involved in stock assessments for the Western and Central North Pacific fisheries, and I was a participant just 2 weeks ago. I was at the Western Central Pacific Fisheries Commission in Busan, meeting with scientists throughout the entire Pacific region, including those, our friends and colleagues here at NOAA, at the Pacific Islands Fisheries Science Center in Honolulu. Some of the emerging issues, obviously, as folks are aware, here in Hawaii, big eye tuna is a major issue and major fish in our market. And the latest stock assessment was optimistic, showing that the stock was neither overfished and was not experiencing overfishing. There were some changes to that stock assessment that were made.
Yeah, I think that's clear. We ought to talk about some of what that was.
Yeah, so there's two major issues of uncertainty in prior assessments that were addressed, one of which is the growth of the animal. So the Secretary of the Pacific Community in, out of New Caledonia with Australian partners collected otoliths, which are ear bones of big eye tuna, and they aged them and to get a contemporaneous growth model, I guess looking at size and age of big eye tuna now. Comparatively, in the past, which they used the frequency of sizes of tuna, big eye tuna, to estimate age classes that are passing through.
Were there surprises? Size. Were this? There, look at the earpiece again.
So so this is one of the first major comprehensive studies. Jessica Farley in Australia conducted that. She actually got the ages of fish throughout the equatorial and the Western Pacific. However, we don't have any samples here in Hawaii that have been aged that are included in that and that population growth model. But that growth equation for the entire stock helped make out the outcome a little bit more optimistic. It was previously thought that the max size, average maximum size of big eye tuna was much larger. So in the fisheries data that we get back, size frequencies, we actually could have possibly have been underestimating the size age of or the age at size for big eye tuna, and therefore coming up with a maybe little overly pessimistic outlook.
Gotcha. You know, better safe than sorry, maybe the attitude. But I think it's interesting that most of the time we talk on this program about stock assessments, it's a little bit more predictable because you're looking usually at an inshore species, whether you're looking at a reef or a coastline of an island to determine how many butterflies there are, or how many mammal there are, or whatever. What are the differences in a stock assessment on a pelagic game fish that is likely to be in any number of areas during its life?
And that's a good question, Mike. We know that billfish, blue marlin, striped marlin, which are assessed here in the Pacific by staff here in Hawaii, and then you have your tuna species. Mm-hmm. Their movements may be dictated by oceanographic processes. Mm-hmm. So typically in stock assessments and for pelagics, they want to use what's a spatially structured model. They want to look at data coming from multiple spatial areas throughout the ocean. Mm-hmm. And as we know, and as the in and our long line industry probably knows better than anyone where, you know, where they're catching fish is not always in the same spot.
Yeah, and that's maybe, can be dictated. Many miles. I mean, many not miles. Just the same spot, but real far away from where they were before.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And there's been some breakthroughs partnering our scientists here at NOAA and then scientists throughout the entire Pacific with oceanographers looking at, well, what are the processes, physical processes that are driving the local abundance of, say, a tuna or billfish? And then also, how are these processes making the fishery or the stock more productive? Are there oceanographic events that are enhancing productivity?
Yeah. Therefore, that's where the ecosystem part of what you do comes in.
Correct.
You know, I mean, to be part of a food chain, you have to have an ecosystem that's going to support it.
Exactly. And, you know, and here in Hawaii, where we have the island effect, we're about as remote as you get between land masses. So the effect of Hawaii as the island effect may be very profound.
I can remember before, and I think we touched upon this last week, and we have another surprise guest that we're going to introduce in a minute that can lay some agreement on this, and that is it was pretty much debatable for decades until it came into effect, I think about 10 or 15 years ago, where there was evidence to support the theory that we had a pretty good-sized yellowfin tuna resident, you know, population, that this was indigenous to us, stayed with us, born here and died here and fed people here, where maybe a lot of times people thought that when there was an anti-longline, you know, sort of feeling, that the big eye and the yellowfin are running together and we're not catching the eye that we used to because the longliners are getting them all. Well, the longliners kind of don't fish where our eye are.
Yeah, and it can vary from time to time as well. I mean, it depends on where the longline fishery operates due to, like I said, environmental conditions that are conducive. And sometimes there is overlap, but oftentimes there's not.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. And even though it wasn't scheduled, we want to welcome my friend Craig Severance back to the studio. He's a Hilo guy. As a matter of fact, just happens to be here in town. And among the things that he does there is he's the waymaster at the Hilo Trollers. We're talking about that just because this big Kiwala Fish Challenge is coming up this week. By the way, if you're hearing this on Saturday, I'm fishing. Just don't try to call me because I'm out fishing. Anyway, Craig is also regarding his role with the council now, the Social Science Planning Committee. He's a chair of that. And I guess first, Craig, it must be nice for you and everybody else here in Hawaii to get a guy of Mark's stature to come to Hawaii and be part of us. And looks like he's riding around town with the right guys to learn a little from.
I'll take that as a compliment.
It is a compliment.
And I'm just getting to know him.
Yeah.
But he knows his statistics.
Yeah.
And he talks to fishermen. And
that's
need to
the
do
bridge.
Both.
You know, that's why I was going to say, a lot of times in the past, and I remember when I used to fill out my catch reports, no fishing, no fishing, no fishing, just because I couldn't be bothered with it years and years ago, that fishermen used to be a little bit more reluctant to me anyway than it seems. Now, when they realize, hey, the science is not always taken away from us. Sometimes, in this case, it might be adding to us.
Yeah, and there's another misconception out there that I myself held for a little while. The way certain stock assessments, particularly the deep seven bottom fish stock assessment, worked, you start with a baseline.
Yeah, yeah.
And if the baseline is lower and they're going to give you a quota, your quota is going to be lower.
Sure.
If the baseline's higher and you're going to get a quota, your quota is going to be higher. And so accurate reporting is really critical for doing good science.
Look at the difference in that, in our generation, at the wonderful, just technical explosion of what's available to help us as aid in this stuff.
Yeah, there's they've done some independent stuff with underwater cameras and fish counts.
Yeah.
But the thing that has done the most to improve the stock assessment is that the stock assessment people have started working closely with fishermen, and they've worked closely with knowledgeable highliners.
We've seen each other at many of the fishers' forums over the years, which is to me the best meeting place for science, the council and folks, you know. And so you're actually in both. You have a foot in both camps. Are you finding, like I am, that people seem to be at least a little bit more willing to talk about stuff rather than reluctant to?
I think so.
Yeah,
but I think it varies by island, and I think it also varies by how much people know. But in my club, at least, we work closely with certain things. So we just distributed a socioeconomic survey through the club.
And what sort of survey was it?
It was from the Human Dimensions Group and then funneled through Pacific Islands Fisheries Group. And it was on your expenditures during tournaments.
So, there you go.
Because, you know, to get the small boat fishery on the map and to get it recognized for the valuable economic contribution it makes, then you need good data. And and hopefully we'll get enough returns from on those surveys so the data will be good.
It was only a few years ago that I remember that the council and others started paying attention to tournament wrap-ups, number of fish caught, number of boats that went out, how long they were in and out, what was the big, what was the small, what classification was empty, what where when were there no ONO. It's pretty valuable stuff.
Yeah, I've always thought it's valuable
stuff.
Yeah, it is. It's a slice.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit of a sample. It's not the only possible sample, but it's useful data.
Fishermen would like to participate.
They would like to contribute.
Yeah.
At least most of them.
Yeah, I agree. And it's sort of interesting because I guess maybe we'll come back to Mark. When you're coming here to Hawaii, there's a very thin line for most of us between commercial and recreational. As a matter of fact, most recreational guys, given the opportunity, if they catch more than they're looking for, they're going to sell or trade something, which then, at least for that day, makes them commercial. So in your work, isn't that going to be part of the deal to blend in the data that comes from, say, like the auctions of the fishmongers and the folks that are selling out of the back of a pickup truck after they catch a lot of fish?
I mean, that information is imperative. Mm-hmm. You know, is getting at the heart of how much biomass is being removed per year is important to make to increase precision, to make our stock assessments and estimates of take from the ocean much more removing some of the uncertainty. And there's nothing, you know, wrong with being a non-commercial fisherman, obviously, because a lot of us, you know, it's a component here in Hawaii.
Yeah.
It's a social component here.
Well, I got an Italian neighbor down the street. Yeah. I give him a fish. Here comes a big pasta thing.
Yeah,
I mean, it's you know, that is beyond my my ability to make it. So I still think, though, that is more a sharing than commercialized. But I do know that different places look at it differently.
Your places look at it differently, you know, and when I was in North Carolina, it's where I'm from, you know, the commercial fishery, there is not really that much gray area, or even in Florida, you're either commercial or you're recreational.
Right.
Although in the Mid-Atlantic, they had for a while what was called a recreational commercial gear license, in which fisherman could buy commercial gear, and I had one of those licenses for when I used to pot crabs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you could have X amount of crab pots, but the idea was that was for your own consumption. It was for your own subsistence. So the minute you sold, there wasn't much gray area there in being able to sell, catch, you know, to help support your family versus just being for a subsistence.
Yeah, and, you know, there's another group, too. And I want to go back to Craig Severance on this because – not only is affiliation with the Hilo Trollers, which is small boats, mostly small boats, then we have another whole group here of fishermen that are the charter guys. And quite often, guests that come here are shocked to find out a little sign in the cabin saying the crew works for fish and tips, meaning that a lot of places they expect when you go fishing, you come home and the captain happily cuts up your fish and throws it in the cooler and puts it in your car for you.
Well, part of the issue here is that we have a lot bigger fish than charter boat fishermen.
Let's hope that that keeps happening.
They continue. Yeah. But if you have a big ahi or a decent-sized marlin, then it's kind of hard for somebody in a hotel to deal with it.
Sure.
But that is...
How would you like me to put this 200-pound ahi in your hotel room?
Yeah.
In the bed.
Yeah. But, you know, the the crew and the captains need to be clear with the customers
up front.
So the customers don't have a misunderstanding and don't get upset. And there has been some outreach and then some enforcement. Mm-hmm. So every charter captain now does have a CML, and those fish go into the database.
Which is terrific. Now, there's another thing, and I know this happens in my community, and I'm sure it happens in yours on the Big Island, all of our neighbor islands. There have been some, you know, people that want more, you know, area-based management. They want to control the fishery. The logic tells us that we have expanded exponentially in the number of people here in the last 100 years. But that doesn't mean that the fish population can keep up with that expansion, does it? So we do have to be very careful and mindful of these quotas and these limits, and maybe seasons for that matter.
Yeah. If you look at the state regulations for nearshore waters, they were actually they derived from what was done in the kingdom time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In terms of the size limits and seasonal limits. But what Hawaiians will tell you is that those things vary by island.
And maybe even by places on the island.
Yeah, and certainly they probably vary between east side and west side of the Big Island. So all of that stuff needs to be kind of looked at again. And marine protected areas can work and help, at least for nearshore fish. I'm not so sure they're very useful for pelagic fish because they move around so much. But for a marine protected area to work, the community has to buy in. If you impose it from the top, it's going to fail.
That's a great point. And the other side of that, to me, Mark, is what Craig is talking about is what we fishermen talk about at the boat ramps and at the bars and everywhere else, thinking that sometimes science and authority is starting to close in on us and prevent us from doing the things we're doing. There are actually arguments within the commercial, within the recreational and charter fishery about who's catching what where. Does that come up in other places you've been around where you take a look at a finite number of fish and increasing number of people want to eat that fish?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a huge issue in Florida. Mm-hmm. It's sort of been very contentious. You had a commercial fishing industry that has sort of declined over the years in Florida, and then you have a commercial fishery that is charter boat based, and then you have your folks, your normal folks who go off and fish. And there's been many debates and issues there because the commercial fisherman is the conduit from the resource to the public. I mean, it's a public resource, and so folks that don't have big boats can't go off and, let's say, catch gag grouper or go catch fish offshore in Florida. It's become a multifaceted conflict. You have the consumer, you have the commercial industry, which is decreased. You have the recreational, then you have the charter boat, then you have the scientist, and then you have a group of environmentalists. Mm-hmm. So it can be quite contentious. And I think here in Hawaii, being proactive and having the conversation early before these conflicts arise, so there is a level of trust between scientists and management, and then as well as along other stakeholders and users here. So.
Yeah, and gang, just to remind you, Mark Fitchett is a scientist with the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. As a matter of fact, his new job is the Pelagic Fisheries Ecosystem Scientist. And Craig Severance is one of us. He's a fisherman and a scientist. I think the science has rubbed off on him, but he's often carried the pennant, if you will, of the flag of the non-commercial, recreational, and club guy, like his club, the Hilo Trollers. I think there's another part of it, Craig, and I think that maybe, a guy like Mark coming in needs to be sort of taught. Don't we have on every island, like at Haena, certainly on Molokai, certainly on the west side of the Big Island, groups that think, we know our fishery more than the guys from NOAA or the guys from Westpac or even the guys from another island. We want to control our beach, or we want to control our fish.
There's a very strong mood out there, and it's strong in parts of the Hawaiian community, but it's also strong in parts of the non-Hawaiian community. The condition of the resource probably does vary tremendously from one island to another. So the state regs, which are statewide, don't always fit.
Yeah.
And maybe they don't fit any place. And I don't mean to be critical of the state, because they're underfunded and they work hard. But it all needs to be looked at.
Yeah.
And well, there are some Hawaiian rights issues that are part of that.
Exactly. And sorry to interrupt, but I want to tell you that I've been talking to some of them that seem to be looking like, okay, we're going to start divisionalizing our comments and our studies. In other words, let's talk about Mempachi, but let's talk about Mempachi on each island, on each side of the island, to be a little fairer so that somebody on a non-fish side of the island doesn't jump in their car, go to the other side of the island, and everybody's fishing on one hole and eliminating the stock in that hole.
Well, there's a wonderful phrase in the video about Ulua Heng bait fishing, Kala'au and Ma'ama'a, where it says, we fish in our own place and we take only what we need.
Yep.
And that's from Uncle Ben Hawaniʻo. And it kind of, to me, it kind of summarizes the idea that everybody should be responsible. Everybody should take it on as their kuleana to protect the resource, to take what they need, and to preserve the cultural value of all the sharing that goes on.
You know, we call that fish flow. You're so right. Yeah. And you know what, gang? This is based on centuries-old information. And thank goodness it didn't completely die off, as we've seen. And I'm sure that you'll be able to, you know, help Mark learn as he's here about our intro stuff. The motion to return to yesterday with some of our young Hawaiians, thank goodness, is to rebuild the lo'i and rebuild the fish ponds and at least, if not being able to use it commercially like before, at least explain the theory of it so people know, like you said, take what you need. If you need some more tomorrow, come back tomorrow. But don't take plenty today and end up either freezing them or throwing them away.
Yeah. It's that. We have a term we like that's called fish flow, which is really what happens to the fish after it's landed.
Yeah.
How does it get shared? And what is the social tie and social bond that is reinforced by that sharing? And it does cross ethnic groups, which is really a fine thing here. But it's very hard to track. And one of the ways you can track it is to talk to people at the end events and ask them where the fish came from.
Whether
it's
the
first baby luau or a graduation ceremony or some other party or a family event. Fish is expected. Local fish is what's needed.
I was MC at a local wedding not too long ago, and I got a couple of notes, and one of them said, please thank Uncle Bubba for the OP. They went out and pounded all these OP. Well, that's a fact, because every now and again, if you are an OP guy, you're going to get a call and say, hey, Craig, can you go pick a couple gallons for my baby luau this week? And you can say, based on if there is, yes, but this is not a good time of year, or no. Yeah, and pretty interesting. And I guess maybe, Mark, when you see sort of the inner layers of some of that stuff, it becomes pretty interesting to sort of look at the big picture. And yet, everybody says we're different. Are we different, or do you come from places that have similar concerns that make us kind of the same?
Well, I mean, I think here in Hawaii, it's all much more pronounced that you have this intrinsic value to fisheries that doesn't really exist in most places in the United States, maybe in Alaska, and certainly in parts in the Southeast where the culture, the local culture revolves around the resource. Mm-hmm. But anywhere you go in Hawaii, it doesn't matter what town, where the everything revolves around the ocean and the sea. And I think there's a certain value that you can't, that I think a lot oftentimes that is overlooked, I think, by scientists.
I got a friend. He's actually an engineer, a radio engineer. And I was following his car one day, and I'd seen him for a while. And he pulled into Craig. He pulled into this parking lot on the beach park. And here's a guy that had his jeans and his stuff on. He put a towel around him. He changed to a pair of shorts. And he grabbed a spear and a stringer from the back of his car, and he went in the water. And then I left. And then I said, hey, I saw you the other day down the beach. He said, yeah, my kid was hungry for fish. So whenever I need fish, I stop off. That's kind of unique to us, isn't it? I mean, this guy's, he just done a full day's work, but he knew to jump in the water. He wasn't necessarily, although I'm sure it is fun for him, he was really there because he wants to feed his kid fish, and he doesn't want to go by him because maybe he can't.
Yeah, and a lot of people get asked.
Yeah.
A lot of people who are known as fishermen, they get asked to provide fish, especially for a
squid,
particular
right?
event. We call that an effort trigger, which means if you're going to understand the value of the fishery, you got to understand the value of those social events and how they help perpetuate local style.
And, you know, there is no gap in them, Mark. I mean, you know, you can expect it. And I guess it's going to be the first holiday the first holiday season when you're here to see the big demand on ahi. When it goes from like $2 or $3 a pound in May and June to $22 or $3 a pound in December, it's a real phenomenon. Do you have those? Look, everybody knows that listens to the program. I have the guys from Wicked Tuna on all the time. Last week, 2 weeks they're on. And when they get in and they're getting the fish, the core sample, and the tail cut and the core sample, and they're feeling it and oiling this and that, I'll get you $22 a pound. And they're disappointed because they're only.
Yeah.
And we'd be flipping out if we could do that. Isn't that amazing, though, that there are people that really have that demand, that need that, like on the East Coast?
I think it is incredible. Yeah. And you know, in the East Coast, it's the there is the market, and it's very strong like it is here. But here, like Craig, I mean, going back, there's something that's really important to have folks like Craig here to kind of help us understand the dynamics of that demand, which is very unique here comparatively to other parts of the U.S. And then also going back to one of your points you made prior before, that stuck out of my mind is part one of our onus, the burdens as a scientist sometimes is being humbled and realizing that PhD on the wall, while that gives you merit, doesn't necessarily trump the years and generations of experience of fishermen
based on
observation, which is extremely important. And I think
me and Craig are laughing. Let me tell you something. In our business, back in the day, you had to have a first-class radio telephone operator's license saying that you could repair the transmitter if you had to. No, nobody could, but that's what you had to have. How many times have you seen, Craig, in Hawaii, somebody saying, well, I'm a doctorate in this, a doctorate of that. You say, really? Well, you'll go stick that in the drawer because we're going to tell you what it really is like here.
If you want to fit in here, say you have.
It's been understanding the years of experience. And that's the same, even back on the East Coast. Yeah. You need to talk to fishermen and understand, because fishermen help us as scientists ask the right questions. And it's extremely important.
I tell you why that's interesting. A couple times I've been fishing in Washington State and even in Alaska when a game warden would come up to our group to inspect tags and licenses. And you think it's so like, holy smokes, because we don't have any of that stuff. We don't realize how lucky we are. But the real fact is when somebody comes up, a scientist or somebody from the council, is to say that, look, I can do my job. I have a degree and I'm a PhD, but I really kind of need to know what's happening in your neck of the woods without family secrets. Can you help me out here?
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that what it's going to be in the final analysis?
Oh, yeah. And you need that anywhere you go. Yeah. And I think here in Hawaii, it's even more important because, you have, hundreds of years of that experience and that understanding of of not only the demand for the resource, but also a little bit different perspective that can't be found anywhere else.
I also want to go back to Craig because I just realized that Craig Severance is here. He's actually from the Big Islands, from Hilo. And it wouldn't be, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you how things fared there. I mean, you guys in that part of the island had some pretty rough times with not only torrential rains, but then the threat of a hurricane and all of that stuff. How's things on the beach?
We have a lot of debarked trees in the bay and outside the bay. We had to delay the start until after full light of our Labor Day Invitational
just
tournament.
Just so they couldn't get through the debris.
And we did have one boat ding a prop. Mm. But we had to encourage everybody to be careful. Mm. And we had good information from other fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
And to get that, you've got to have trust and respect. Yeah. Good information from other fishermen about what the conditions were the 2 days before the tournament.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we would have canceled.
Yeah. And, when you say that, it's with I happen to be in this one that I'm out fishing today. If you're listening on Saturday afternoon, I'm hoping I'm at the weigh station, weighing in some monster. But even if we don't, I think the interaction here, and I guess, Craig, we haven't talked about this before, but I'm guessing the quintessential place to be is in a place like Hilo when these guys get together. So for those that don't know, the Hilo Trollers, what size of boats and how many ballpark members are there?
Well, we've got about 60 members. Yep. We've got about 24 boats. Our biggest boat is 26.
Mm-hmm.
Our smallest is 16.
Yeah.
And if you're on the board, when that 16-foot is out, it makes you a little nervous. But the guy's experienced and he knows what he's doing. I'd say average a lot of Force 21s, a couple of Force 22s, and other mixture. Mostly outboards, mostly trailerable, and mostly local guys, some of whom fish pretty regularly and have good information on recent bite, and some who fish as Weekend Warriors.
Yeah, the Weekend Warriors. Yeah, yeah, like many, just, many. Yeah. But it's sort of interesting. It must be for you, Mark, that the biggest boat in that fleet is like the smallest boat in other areas. And our guys will go 30, 40 miles out in an 18, 20 footer to catch fish because they know how to do it and they know that they can get back. And they know that, Craig, that the spirit of, okay, I know it's in a tournament, but you need help, I'm going to come and tell you.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, bar none. So I guess maybe that's sort of a good way to get you introduced, Marcus, to, you know, some of the things that are going on. But before we leave, also, what are the expectations? How are you going to go and approach people, given the opportunity in the field, with these sentiments that we've been expressing?
Well, I mean, it's just, you got to come in with you got to earn the trust of folks that you're speaking to, as well, and also from other scientists as well, you know, because council's perspective is different, even among scientists. We're here to, you know, to sort of guide, more at least in my position, guide the direction of some of the of the pelagic fisheries research in the region. But one component of that is working with our fishermen and our partners. Mm-hmm. So you have to at least show some a little bit of humbleness and willingness to listen and to be approachable. That's the main thing that I think you know, a lot of scientists struggle with. I imagine it's not much different, you know, even anywhere you go, you got to learn how to talk and interact with a lot of these fishermen.
You know, let me tell you how true that is. Craig made mention of it earlier. I do this all the time. The first thing somebody does here that really says, if they say, back home we did this and back home we did that, sometimes they get kind of a dirty look from us. Well, this is our home, and that's not the way we do it.
You might get more than a dirty look.
Yeah.
Because
showing the door.
You've got to be humble, and arrogance doesn't fly.
Oh, listen, it's all Craig Severin from Hilo. Nice seeing you, my friend. And Mark, thanks and good luck. Well, I'm sure we're going to see you again.
I'll be around.
Okay, and everybody, don't forget, if you'd like to hear something on the show, it's pretty easy. Drop me a line, email the best way, themikebuckshow@gmail.com, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. In addition to Craig Severance and Mark Fitchett, our big thanks to Dr. Andy Rossiter from the Waikiki Aquarium on the death of Maka'ona'ona. Have a great rest of your weekend. We'll see you next time on Go Fish.